Today's podcast is sponsored by Shudder, the premier streaming video service built to specifically super serve fans of all degrees of thrillers, suspense, and horror. For a free 30 days of streaming, go to shudder.com/podcast. That's shudder.com/podcast and use promo code BALDMOVE.
Hey everybody, welcome to Bald Move Television, the official podcast for all of television.
What? When did we become official?
Well, you know, it's for all of television. We don't need anyone's permission for that.
Oh, that's true. We are TV.
Yeah. I know we cover literally all of television. These next few weeks, we want to really narrow our focus down to this HBO miniseries, Sharp Objects. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about that in here in a bit. But before that, I figured we'd still stick with the all of television and talk about a big change. There's been some mergers in the entertainment world of late, and HBO has found itself now owned by AT&T
via Time Warner merger.
What do we think about this news? Because I know there's an article in the New York Times that kind of laid out some of John Stankey.
His name is Stankey.
It's Stankey.
I'm just gonna call him that.
This article dated July 8th seems to indicate that Mr. Stankey wants to spend a lot of time, money, and treasure to move HBO to be a bit more Netflix-like and have its appeal be broader and more popular, more populist.
In the search of ever more treasure, apparently.
We spoke about this briefly yesterday, and I was surprised to hear that you weren't on the face of it, disturbed or bothered, because you know HBO is one of our, I think it is the flagship channel. It's what everybody else measures itself in terms of critical success, artistic endeavor, quality. There you go. Like when you hear HBO, it's like their whole thing is we're not television, we're HBO.
Right.
Now they're not television or HBO. They want to be Netflix.
They want to be the premier online streaming platform, I guess.
Yeah.
And they've been in that battle for a while with Netflix. And so far it has taken the shape of, hey, we're HBO and we're doing streaming just as good as Netflix.
Right.
From a technical perspective, now we also have Game of Thrones, which is irresistible to everyone on the planet.
Biggest show on the planet, literally.
Yeah. And so that was driving a lot of their success as a streaming platform.
Uh-huh.
You know, just from a subscribership up until, I know, at least 2017... I think that battle was raging, and HBO and Netflix were like neck and neck for number one.
Right.
Like profitability. And HBO has always been very profitable. You know,
right.
Over the course of the last 3 years, they've taken in like $6 billion worth of profit from their various interests. So not really an issue as far as like money making, right? $2 billion a year is not bad.
Right.
When they're spending $2 billion a year to make their shows, it's 100% return on their investment.
Right.
But apparently for Mr. Stankey, that is not enough. And I was like on the face of it because I hadn't actually gone and read the words or listened to the audio, which is what New York Times got a hold of from this conference. And so I was not like super familiar with it. And I was thinking, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe more is not always worse. You know, if you can keep that high quality and you can just do more of it, maybe that'd be a good thing for everybody. And so initially, yeah, that was not my thought was not, oh, they're going to ruin this by trying to do more. After reading the transcript of the tapes of the recordings, I feel very differently because it seems like this is a money for money's sake sort of thing, and consequences be damned, I guess.
Yeah, because it also seems like it's the often heard refrain when someone takes over that buckle up because you thought you're going to work harder than you've ever hired. He compared it to childbirth, the year of labor that they have. I don't know if Mr. Stankey knows this, but childbirth is not a condition that lasts 12 months.
That's true.
It has a beginning and like there's a lot of things that suck about being pregnant. But the actual labor, what he described it, is a definite period of time that is miserable. But it begins and ends. This seems like he's just putting the company on kind of a death march, or you know, anytime I hear a executive say "buckle up" things are about to get tough, I think, you know, it's just like if an executive tells me, your new job might involve some travel, I figure I'm going to be on the road 50% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they say it's a lot of travel, then, like, say goodbye to your friends and family.
Yeah,
you'll see them 2 weeks
out. Sell your house.
Right.
Just rent an Airbnb when you go home.
Exactly. Exactly. I don't know. Like, this guy, so I'm going to take a few quotes here. He says, "We need hours a day," referring to the time viewers spend watching HBO program. Not hours a week, not hours a month. We need hours a day. You are competing with devices that sit in people's hands that captured attention every 15 minutes. Why? Why do we need hours a day? I don't need hours a day.
His explanation was that they need more data so that they can tailor the experiences to the audience to try and optimize that stream, that data stream, I guess.
But I just, hours a day, I don't know that, I mean, to me, that's completely opposite of the HBO experience. It'd be like if King's Island's executive said, "We don't want this to be something that people just come for a couple of days a year, or maybe like once a week if they're local. We want someone to spend their lives here." Like, that's not the park, man. The whole idea of it is you get away from, like, if it's every day, then you want something else to escape from that. I don't know, because, like, this is not how I interact with television. I kind of do appointment television. I there's things that are good, and I like to sit. I know that there's a lot of people to watch a lot more television than I do, but, like, this shit actively scares me.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, when he says stuff like that and about the amount of labor he's going to wring out of the employees, it also makes it seem like that it's not going to be just an expanse of content. It's also going to be as somewhat of a loss of quality, because to me, those things are like opposite things. It's like, do you want something to be high end and very high quality, or do you want something to be like mass produced? Like, it'd be like saying that to me that they're incompatible terms.
I think they're, in my mind, close to that. Like, I think there are rare exceptions to that idea, where quality can remain high while something is mass produced. I think of like Apple products, and the quality on those is always very, very high. Like, build quality, UI design, all of that stuff is very high, and they're still considered like premium products, you know, and they're mass produced. They're like millions and millions of units.
There you go. Like, no one has. So they're like, if you could essentially take Game of Thrones and do Game of Thrones version 2.0 and make it the best thing, and then, but you can't mass produce that. You can't literally make.
Right.
You know,
I guess a better analog would be like, what if they tried to make 60 different products instead of the 4 that they make?
Right.
And they tried to mass produce. Not from a unit perspective, but a product perspective.
So then you'd have like the Android environment where it's like everything's fragmented and you're not sure what's going to be this. I mean, I don't want to start a big Android versus Apple war, but like, I mean, he also says the philosophy that HBO has pursued thus far has commanded deep loyalty from the audience. He says, "You've earned a dynamic amongst your customer base that when you put on a new piece of content out there, people will try it just because they trust you're going to be putting something in front of them that they might like."
Correct.
Do you know who's lost that?
Netflix.
Fucking Netflix.
Yeah.
I do not want, I don't try anything unless somebody that I trust and respect says they've tried it and they like it, because there's just too much of that stuff. And also, like, I've been burnt time and time again by many Netflix episodes that have these big, flabby, saggy middle sections. Every one of the freaking Marvel properties, a lot of times Orange is the New Black. In fact, it's easier to find the ones that seem like they're lean and mean, like Stranger Things. You know, like, that seems like that's more of the HBO model. That's a finely crafted Fabergé egg. It's not just like, oh, here is, you know, 13 servings of Luke Cage. We only have enough ingredients to make 6 of them, but we've added a shit ton of flour and water, and boy howdy, it's more of it.
Right.
It's not good.
No, it gets diluted. And I have seen that happen, right? Like, I think back to the time when Netflix was producing essentially 3 or 4 shows, like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, and those all felt like big premieres, like things I didn't want to miss on Netflix. And now there's literally a new episodic show coming out every week on Netflix, if not
multiple times a week.
Yeah, more often. And I just, A, I simply don't have time to catch them all. And B, I'm being presented with the stuff regardless of whether it would appeal to me.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's like an algorithm problem. Maybe like if Netflix didn't show me the stuff that it didn't think I was going to like at all, if it never advertised that stuff to me, maybe that would be something that they could do. And if HBO tried to do that, but I think agree that it would be difficult to maintain the quality of HBO and that early Netflix stuff and just make 10 times as much. That's what they're going to have to do to compete with Netflix.
And I think
on that battlefield.
Because to me, it's like it's obvious in this instance, since you can't just you can't just refine a design of a phone and then make 100 million copies of it and people buy it. You have to, like, if he said, hey, we're going to get bigger, and here's, in the next 5 years, we're going to be doubling our creative executive staff so we can go out and scout new projects. We're going to be doubling the amount of executive producers we have. We're going to be fine. But it seems like he just wants to crank productivity to maximum without doing any of the... It's kind of like the difference between Marvel and DC, right? Marvel carefully constructed something over a decade and now gets billion-dollar... movie releases that they take for granted because people like, yeah, this is good. This is all going to be like, I expect a certain amount of quality, where DC wanted to, they saw what Marvel was doing, like, oh, we're just going to do that. But we're not going to carefully build the foundation. We're just going to jumpstart it, and the thing has fallen over like a house of cards. And man, that would suck so bad if HBO gets drug through the mud like that.
Yeah. I wonder how much control they have over this.
I don't know. And the thing is,
at this point,
it might be a good business decision. Like, I could see HBO making more money that way. Because if they did it my way and slowly built it over the course of time, maybe their profits rise, but their costs would soar too, because staffing up and optioning all that stuff is going to be expensive and making it. But I don't know. It's like, it's one of those perverse things where the shareholders' value might be better under this new regime, but the artistic quality would be much worse.
Yeah, it does very much feel like trying to trade the trust that you've built over many years for money, essentially. And knowing that you're going to spend that capital, that trust capital that you've built up in that process, and if it doesn't work, well, now you fucked your original business model over,
right?
Because people no longer trust you. Like, if you can't get to the point where you are Netflix and the volume exceeds like whatever, you know, trust that you had built in your audience, then you're just screwed, because you've destroyed your original business model. Your new business model didn't work out.
Right.
Now you have no business, no viable business anyway.
And this happens a lot. I think you'd be familiar with the example of Gibson Guitars. I know this is a right example. Maybe it's Les Paul, or maybe it's something. I don't know. But some manufacturer, like,
I mean, they are, I think they're the same.
Okay,
Gibson, Les Paul.
But let's take a step back.
Okay,
many brands that have high quality struggle because, you know, they're doing their thing and they're selling these things. They have this really strong, and they have super brand loyalty, but they're stagnant because they're not growing, okay? So a company buys them out and then pump and dumps it. Like, they raid all the goodwill, they convert all that goodwill into revenue, and then the company is left in shambles. I can think of lots of different companies. I'm sure everyone can, but like, it's just weird to see something like this where, like, because I've seen it happen to, like, you know, yeah, guitar companies and firearm manufacturers and car companies and different stuff like that. But I've never seen it happen to, like, I guess, an entertainment brand where someone just snatched it up and they're just going to run it into the ground. And I don't know, but that's like, it's a microcosm, because companies love to look for other companies that have like fat retirement accounts. So that's just fat. We can just trim all that stuff off, convert it to different options, and just. And it's a sickness, man. I don't know what the cure is.
And it would be different if I thought that, you know, that HBO was on the verge of dying because business models are changing and consumer habits are changing. But ultimately, I don't see that problem for HBO. It's been the number one, sometimes number two, neck and neck, like I said earlier, streaming platform on the internet.
And it always like HBO is the 800-pound gorilla in award season.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like no one else.
That's the reason
even close.
It competes with Netflix, not right. because it has the volume.
And it's the reason it commands a pretty high price too.
Uh-huh.
Like with a fraction of the library that Netflix has got, I pay as much, if not slightly more, for access to HBO content than I do to Netflix, even though there's 100 times more of it.
Mm-hmm.
And Netflix is, I don't get it.
Yeah, if HBO was in trouble, like its streaming platform wasn't working because it didn't have the content it needed, then I could see, you know, doing something radical to change the business model for the future. But in this regard, I don't think it's warranted.
No,
it seems to just be a money grab.
Yeah. And again, the other thing that I think they don't realize is that this is the same thing like the video game glut that happened in the 80s. There's a limited amount of time people have to invest in entertainment.
Yeah.
And Netflix is already way oversaturated that market. If HBO goes after that, then what's the chance that they're going to give Netflix a 10-year head start down that and catch them and run them down and usurp them? Because if not, they're going to massively dilute the quality of their product for absolutely zero gain.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the most likely course it's going to run, and I don't there's nothing we can do to stop it.
It's interesting because like when 2-3 years ago Netflix was talking about being the HBO of online streaming, right. I feel like somewhere along the way they said, you know what, HBO is really, really good at what they do,
right?
And we have this other avenue where we can outcompete them on quantity,
right?
So let's go down that avenue. Now it's completely reversed, and HBO is chasing Netflix on the thing that they're good at. Like, are they going to learn? Is this going to be a learning point where they try to go down this road and it doesn't work, and they go, you know what? HBO has always been good at quality.
Right.
Let's pivot back to that.
I don't know, man, because it's like that's...
Will it be too late when they learn that lesson?
It's like this feels like this some guy that doesn't know what he's doing is coming in here and saying a bunch of buzzwords and, like, you know, putting his mark on it, whether it's good or bad. He doesn't, because, you know, another 5 years he'll move on and do it again to some other place.
And like, AT&T has never been known for their quality.
Right.
They have been known for quantity because they had some exclusive iPhone contracts.
Sure,
and they had millions of people sign up for that. Quantity is their game.
Right.
So they're coming in looking at this saying, let's up the quantity.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I think it's pretty bad. And it's too, because like it's also important to Bald Move because, you know, a lot of our... a lot of the shows that kind of pay the bills around here are the like the deep immersive experiences and like really profound things. And like does Leftovers get greenlit in this environment? Does like what happens when Nolan and Joy are like, hey, we're going to take 2 years off from making Westworld. And this guy goes, no, crack the whip. I want it out in 6 months. I need this thing turned around in 6 months. We need more. In fact, spin off Westworld. I need a samurai world. I need a Roman world. I saw the damn movie. There's a castle. Where's my castle? Like, this guy's a lunatic. He needs to be stopped.
Okay. Yeah.
And I don't know what we can do to stop it, but...
Probably nothing. I don't even think the CEO of HBO can do anything.
I mean, apparently not, because he does say... Yeah. I mean, he was there seeming, like, from the quote, seeming like helpless and bewildered by the whole thing.
I mean, he is. He is helpless to the powers of the parent company.
So. Great. I mean, one idea we could do is stop all this merging insanity.
Hey, that's a great idea.
Start busting some of these media companies up, in fact.
Yeah?
Maybe?
Really?
Or maybe just Disney should buy everything.
Yeah, just let's get it all consolidated under one company.
Right.
And then that'll be easier to petition the one guy at the top to do the things we want.
Yeah. just like, you know, there's less competition for his, you know, for their attention. So no competition, in fact. Like, talk about like how much more profitable it'll be when you're like the only game in town. I don't see a downside to it. Do we want to talk about sharp objects now, Jim?
Sure. Real quick, before we move on, I wanted to talk about our sponsor for today, and that is Shudder. It's Shudder. Like, you're scared. Like, that just gave me the shudders. Shudder is a premium streaming video service built specifically for fans of thrillers, suspense, and horror. They have the largest, fastest-growing, human-curated section of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. And I think the human curated is important because a lot of times things can get lost in algorithm And with a specific focus like this, you want to have the best of the best.
It's like a difference between like a good college radio station and then like a Clear Channel.
Yeah, yeah. You just don't hear the same cool stuff on the Clear Channel.
Deep cuts. Yeah. You want the deep cuts.
And they have a lot of deep cuts. Every single week, they're adding new spine-tingling thrillers, shocking horrors, and edge-of-your-seat suspense. Some of the stuff that I like in their unique collection, they have exclusive stuff like documentaries that are only on Shudder. One of them is like Document of the Dead, which is about George Romero, obviously. Anything of the dead is kind of owned by Romero. Mm-hmm. And they have Crystal Lake Memories, which is a Friday the 13th documentary, like history of, which I thought sounded pretty cool. And then they also have horror classics and blockbuster hits. Cube is one of my favorite horror movies of all time. Like, actually, there's a series of them. And they have them all, but Cube, the original, is people trapped inside a cube or a series of cube-arranged rooms that are trying to kill them actively, and they're trying to escape. It's a pretty cool... The premise sounds, like, really simple and dumb, but I actually think it's cool how they construct that whole thing. So check that out if you sign up. Speaking of signing up, right now we are able to offer a free 30 days of streaming. And all you have to do is go to shudder.com/podcast. As I mentioned, that's shudder.com/podcast, and use the promo code BALDMOVE. You'll get unlimited access to stream ad-free on all your favorite devices, such as iOS or Android devices, Roku, Amazon or Google streaming devices. That, once again, that is shudder.com/podcast, and use the promo code BALDMOVE.
This is the point in the episode where we're talking about sharp objects. We're going to spend a couple minutes talking about our general opinions of the pilot, because I know this is a brand new thing. You know, this is something kind of we're doing unconventional with Bald Move, since this is a mini series instead of spinning it off into its own feed. We're just going to cover it here in Bald Move TV, because there will not be a Sharp Objects 2. Well, I don't know. Maybe Stanky will get in there.
Stanky, yeah. Sharp Objects 2.
We need sharper objects. I need sharpest objects. So yep. That's how we're covering it.
Can I say that this being an 8-episode miniseries is so refreshing coming off of something... Going into one of our largest shows in terms of, like, mythos. Mm-hmm. Like, Game of Thrones is such a big beast at this point, where you have to remember 7 seasons of things that have happened, and if you're a book reader, it's even more. This is such a breath of fresh air, because I don't have any baggage going into this, and I'm not going to have any baggage coming out of it.
Right.
It feels so liberating.
I totally agree, and we can talk more about that. What did you think of the premiere episode?
I thought it was really good. I was drawn in by the Amy Adams.
Okay.
That's the thing I came to this show for.
You came for the Amy Adams. You stayed for...
I stayed for the HBO. I stayed for the True Detective. How about that?
Okay.
This show seems like True Detective in a lot of ways.
This is a Midwestern Gothic as opposed to Southern Gothic, which means...
It's got that noir.
Slightly chubbier, less alligators and salt water.
Less accents.
Overall cholesterol levels might be slightly higher.
There's still a lot of accents. This is like somewhere between Midwest and Southern to me.
There is the line. It's kind of like when you get in Kentucky and Tennessee, like the line starts to get pretty, you know, the accents rapidly get drawlier as you cross state lines. But I think Missouri is still solidly Midwest.
Yeah, they do say that St. Louis Gap is like very close to Tennessee, I think, very Southern.
Yeah, and I guess like maybe that's the difference between like... you know, like St. Louis, I think, is a quintessential Midwestern town. It might be my favorite Midwestern town. Hmm. That and Chicago's into running. But it is. It doesn't feel like a Dallas or a San Antonio or a, you know, New Orleans or anything like that. I like this a lot. And what drove... I really enjoyed the town because, like, this town, when you're driving through, it looks so much like a lot of towns I grew up in and spent a lot of time in my youth. It reminds me very much of the Mooresvilles, the Martinsvilles, the Shelbyvilles. I will say this town is a lot more racially diverse than any of is that an anachronism, or I wonder if there are.
I think it's as you approach the South, you start to get.
I guess because like
sort of blend.
All of the small towns I grew up in Indiana were like literally 99% white. So like that was an interesting detail. But yeah, like I love the town because it felt like a real place. Even though it's not a real place. I was at spent a what about 15 minutes trying to find a wind gap on the map, and then I finally searched and like, no, this is a fictitious town. It's kind of like set in a place where the author is familiar, but it's not a real town.
Okay.
I thought that was an interesting choice. Why not just make it a real town? You got a film there,
I don't know.
Then?
Not sure.
There's no Hawkins, Indiana, too. Like, I guess that's a...
Yeah.
If you want to set kind of a place very specific but non-specific.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really liked the relationship between... well, I don't really like. I found it harrowing and triggering, the relationship between Amy Adams and her mother here, Camille and her mother, because she is just this massive passive-aggressive narcissist, and everything just escalates... just so quickly and unbelievably and terrifyingly, like it was really giving me like flashbacks of that, and that felt very accurate and lived in. So
yeah, it's maybe the most the thing that felt most accurate to me from like, I mean, my parents aren't like that. I know some people whose parents are like that.
Right.
Stuff that I've read, like the book Hillbilly Elegy, is essentially an account of a woman just like this, or a man whose mother is just like this.
Mm-hmm.
It felt very real.
Mm-hmm.
Very real. And we sometimes on this show, you know, second guess like the motivations of characters and like, why are they acting this way? What could drive someone to act so weird? But this is one of those relationships that I understand.
You're right.
From having experience with it, where the mother is very overbearing and, like you said, very narcissistic, makes everything about herself.
Right.
When her daughter returns to town after not speaking for months and months, suddenly it's all about the way her actions are going to reflect on the mother. You know, it's a really fucked up relationship. And the most fucked up thing is that there's some deference shown by Camille to her mother.
Right.
Like, she doesn't point out what bullshit this is and how her mother's a narcissist and all this stuff. She goes along with it. She apologizes for her actions, you know, prematurely apologizes. She hasn't done anything yet.
Right.
And it's disgusting, but it's also so completely accurate to a family like that.
Yeah. And it's like, as you point out, like, I think that's part of the dance, because if Camille had just been like, you know what, Mom, this was a bad idea. Let's go another couple months without seeing each other. Deuces. Enough of that behavior or like that modification applied over time might make the relationship tolerable, but she does the dance, and as you see the next day, like her gives her mom license to be even more of a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
And I this is only the first episode out of 8. I cannot wait to see what kind of bottom barrel toxicity that we end up plumbing by the end of it. But also, like, as you mentioned a lot of things about the character, like there's a lot of mysterious things that they introduce about her throughout this hour of television, and we don't know all the answers, but all the suggestions we see are bad. Like every bit of this childhood, and like there is just like the question is how grim and uncomfortable it's going to get, not whether it was there's no like, you know, oh, well, Amy Adams is a spoiled little trust fund baby and she doesn't that. No, she has legitimate things that she's lashing out and out and about. The other thing is, did you feel any fatigue when you realized that this is going to be another kind of like unreliable narrator? Maybe things are real, maybe things aren't real, there might be a supernatural aspect. I don't want to talk spoilers because we're about to go from the general to the specific, but what did you think when you started seeing some of this stuff, like, oh, there's a message that wasn't there, oh, open a door and there's something there, and close the door, it's not there?
This gave me Westworld flashbacks, because we just got off of the Westworld podcast. I was a little worried about that throughout the episode, but they always had a way of grounding me in this is just a flashback.
Yeah.
For the most part. Or these are just, you know, things that she's seeing because of her history with the place. Not necessarily, hey, there's some kind of weird supernatural thing or time travel or something like that. I'm not certain the story's not going to go in those directions.
Right.
And I guess I'll be okay with it. But here's the bottom line. I'm not willing to engage very heavily with this show in that way.
Right.
So if it wants me to, like, figure out the mystery of these, the stuff that's going on with the words, right. for instance, I'm not really going to do that. I'm not going to go down that. I will engage with the mystery of the missing girls, or I guess, you know, let's not say too much, but the missing girls.
Yeah. I mean, this is the premise. There's two girls that gone missing in her hometown, and she's sent there to do an investigative report on it.
Right. So I will engage with that mystery.
Yeah.
The sort of noir murder mystery.
Right.
That's fine. But the other stuff, I don't know. I'll just wait and see on that stuff.
So, like, I think my proportion to engage with this kind of stuff is, or my willingness is directly in proportion to my faith I have in the showrunner delivering something that's going to be a definitive ending conclusion. Mm-hmm. Westworld, like, going off of season one, I was really, really ready to engage with that stuff. Season two kind of, like, killed a little bit of that enthusiasm. Mm. I'm a little bit more willing to engage with in this thing because, like, man, seven more episodes, it's done. Like, it might be an unsatisfying end. It might be a great end. It might be somewhere in the middle. It might be something where you're kind of scratching your head and it's up to you to decide, kind of little, like, leftovers. But it's going to be over one way or another, and I don't need to think. I didn't need to hold this universe into my head for sharper objects later on to like, oh, now the word moved from her pinky to her ankle, and I guess, like, the definitive, like, I can see the light at the end of the tunnel already makes me a little bit more.
Gotcha.
However, doing some basic research, it's very hard to avoid book spoilers.
I have to imagine. I have done zero research on the show for,
like,
that reason.
I made all my notes before this, but, like, I saw Joanna Robinson wrote an article on Vanity Fair, and, like, within the first paragraph, I had gotten something that I shouldn't have resolved already. And it's a bummer.
Boy.
So, like,
is that because of book spoilers or is that maybe screeners?
I think it's book spoilers because she's saying essentially, like, you know, because there's a lot of, I think at this point, if you haven't seen it and you're intrigued, you should shut off the podcast now because we're going to start talking. We're starting to start talking specifics.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about Camille herself, the main character, Amy Adams. And man, the casting, I think Amy Adams is great.
Yeah.
My initial exposure to her was more in, like, her being in kind of, like, you know, plucky kind of romantic comedies or
like The Office. Yeah.
Yeah. More like, that's not her.
There are two Pams.
Oh, yes.
There's
you're right. You're
like
right.
Pam and New Pam or Pam and Hot Pam. I can't remember, but yes.
But
she's a purse salesperson.
But then I started seeing her in, like, some really serious stuff. Like, the one that really made me, like, sit up and take notice is her turn in Arrival, wasn't it?
Yes, that was a great movie.
And I thought she was, man, I think she's amazing in this. And Sophia Lillis, who plays the young version of her, the teenage version, who I first saw in Stephen King's It last year, is, I mean, the casting, like, it literally looks like that could be a young Amy Adams.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, it is uncanny.
Maybe with just a little bit of nose work.
Right.
A little plastic surgery on the nose.
Right.
Over the ensuing 20 years. Or alcoholism, I don't know. Maybe that'll shrivel your nose up.
There's so many great actors. Patricia Clarkson plays the mother, who's very imperious and brittle and fragile, but also scary. Elizabeth Perkins plays, like, her I mean, everyone in this town's boozy. Like, everyone in this town has a cocktail in their hands at all times. Mm-hmm. The cast is really amazing. But I want to talk about Emil a little bit, which is, I'm not sure whether she's crazy, drunk, like is this like the things that where she's seeing things and not seeing things, are we supposed to, or is this the way that they're visualizing inner monologues? Like,
right.
I could see in the novel where she steps into her mom's house for the first time and has a flashback to her and her sister having a fight or something.
Mm-hmm.
But the way she physically seems to get caught up and the massive substance abuse, like, makes it seem like maybe some of this stuff is actually happening. Like, she's just, mm-hmm. she's not in control of the experience. And I think that's interesting, culminating in the last reveal where she is just covered head to toe in this word salad scars.
Right.
I would assume in any other show that that's real, but I've seen leading up to this, words like there was, I saw her Volvo, there it was clean, and then she shuts it and it's got dirt written on it. Mm-hmm. She's playing with the radio and it says wrong.
Yeah. There's and even the word dirt on the back of the car changes to dirty at one point.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know what to make of that. And then on second thought, on second watch, they do a lot of clever things here, too. On second watch, I noticed that she wears stuff that essentially covers everything part of her body that would be scarred. So, mm-hmm. like, if you, I was looking like, well, maybe she rolls up her sleeves at one point and I can see, you know, like the clean hood that doesn't say dirty to establish, but they never give you that.
And they also make a point of how hot it is and how so many of the other characters are walking around with short sleeves and dresses and stuff like that.
But I was like, I don't know what this, because like it feels like it could be misdirection, but like misdirection mm-hmm. on top of misdirection. So they get you thinking this one thing about the words, and then they hit you with the end. And
right.
What do you think? Do you think those are actual real scars?
I think those are real scars, although I'm curious how she would get scars like that on her back.
Right.
Or places that are very, very hard for a human being to reach on themselves.
Right.
Does she have someone, an accomplice, helping her
out? Could be.
Are these supernaturally appearing? You know, questions like that. You know, if she can see them in the landscape or her car or dollhouses,
mm-hmm.
maybe these things just appear on her.
Yeah.
You know?
You mentioned supernatural, and that's the other thing I thought, because, like, I got a distinctly possible supernatural vibe from the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the first episode, her sister and her start talking about ghosts.
Yeah.
And how maybe something leaves behind to attend to unfinished business. And I don't know whether this is going to be a True Detective kind of thing where, like, her various substance abuses leads to her seeing some kind of cosmic thing that's not real, kind of like a Russ Cole type of deal, or there's actually going to be ghosts, or this was just thematic. What's your feeling on the paranormal after one episode?
Like I said, I think they've been very careful not to push it over the edge in either direction.
Yeah.
So I still think that is possible. I'm at the moment I'm leaning toward, like, with the final shot and the scarring, I'm leaning toward not supernatural,
right?
Just all in her head kind of thing,
right?
This is something that is haunting her, for, you know, I guess pun intended there,
yeah.
And causing her to see these things in the environment and remember these flashbacks.
What do you think about the wealth? Because she mentions, like, when her boss when her boss is giving her this assignment and saying, you know, this is the thing you need to get you back on your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Which there's a lot of there's so many implications here because when we talk about the scar, I'm convinced that none of the teenage versions of her that we've seen so far have any scarring, because we see her run mm-hmm. around a cheerleader outfit.
Yeah,
we see her run around lots of stuff.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like there's any scarring there. I would put her, like, you know, Amy Adams herself is in her early 40s. I think that's about right.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people on the forums pointed out that if you're a hardcore alcoholic for 20 years, you're not going to look like Amy Adams. And this guy's saying something, get back on your feet. Do you think that she has had some kind of, like, recent thing that does reawaken all this and she's turned to alcohol? Do you think she's been hitting the bottle ever since she left Wind Gap? What?
Right. I mean, her sister's death was kind of something that set her in a bad direction.
Right.
Whether her alcoholism started there or later, I think you're right. I think the show is pushing it toward there's some other event that's more recent.
Mm-hmm.
Because they also mentioned that she hasn't spoken to her mother in several months.
Right.
So maybe something went bad there. I'm not sure, but it does seem like there's another catalyst here for her alcoholism.
One other piece of evidence is that we see after she goes without alcohol for several hours, her hands begin to shake when the police are, because, you know, she hasn't had a drink. So she's, like, physically dependent on it. And
yeah.
And I think that's the other thing that I think people in the forums were misunderstanding. Like, if you are a hardcore alcoholic, you don't experience alcohol the way normal people do. You're not mm-hmm. drinking like Amy Adams is not, like, careening around, you know, soups, like if you, like, you or I were to drink a fifth of alcohol, we'd be blasted out of our minds.
Right.
She's drinking just so her hands don't shake and so she can function.
Yeah, I mean, three drinks to a person like that is
right.
just getting close to normal.
And she can still tie one on, like, at the bar when she starts right. rocking out to whatever it was, and then she passes out in her car, gets black. She can still do that, but, like, her drinking yeah. those airline, like, that felt like a system. Or like Cecily pointed out, that also that's like a classic alcoholic thing. Like, well, I can't be an alcoholic. I'm drinking out of, I'm drinking right. These little
when
bottles.
When you drink 12 of them, you know, over the course of 4 hours.
But it's like maybe her way of like trying to say like, I haven't completely given up. Like when you start buying the fifths but she's also
buying in bulk.
She also
like
drinks
Costco for your booze.
Yeah, and she's drinking them out of water bottles and stuff.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's where I think it crosses the line. When you take an Evian bottle and fill it with vodka.
And you're drinking it as you're driving down to Wind Gap. A pretty bad.
When you're drinking it as you're driving to the bar. That's pretty bad.
But like I thought it was interesting that her family is rich, but we see that she lives in what looks like just a shitty part of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. She drives a Volvo that sounds like my grandfather's old Ford 3000 tractor. Like she herself does not have any of that wealth. Mm-hmm. So there's not any kind of like Gilmore Girls style. Well, I'm going to appease my mom just enough to get the fat pay. Like she has gone cold turkey off of the family's fortune. As she says, she's trash from
I wonder if that could be part of the catalyzing event.
Right.
Maybe she had, you know, a better relationship or at least a tenable relationship with her mother. Mm-hmm. who was feeding her money to live better than a journalist's salary would let her.
Yeah, but she's still living in a shithole part of town driving a shithole car.
Right, but let's say her mother was paying her rent.
Or maybe that Volvo was really nice 15 years ago. Because, like, you know what I'm saying?
But I mean, if she's got a leased car and her mother's paying her rent and suddenly that's cut off,
and she has to downshift.
You're going and getting a new apartment because you can't afford the one your mom was paying for, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe. I see no evidence for that. I'm just guessing.
Okay. Do you have anything you want to talk about more about Camille? Because I want to talk about the town a little bit before we go into other topics.
So there's this relationship with her half-sister, right? Where she sees her out and about in town. The half-sister doesn't mention, hey, I'm your half-sister. I know who you are. But later, when they're in the house, she finally figures out who that is.
Uh-huh.
And she seems to have a very rebellious nature, we'll call it, and that they're very much alike.
Mm-hmm.
I'm worried about that. I'm worried about that relationship because this is a young girl who's got to be, what, 15, maybe?
Yeah.
And I'm just worried where that thing is going.
Yeah,
because we're talking about a murder mystery with teenagers here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And an alcoholic half-sister who's also rebellious. It's scary.
And who's sneaking around at her mom and dad.
Yeah.
It's funny because, like, that's another thing I strongly identified with because I guess I was the Emma of the family when my sister was the Camille. Like, I wore the suits and I gave the Bible talks and I underlined my watchtower and I knocked on people's doors and my sister was smoking dope and getting tattoos and hanging out with, you know, worldly boys. And I even remember having conversations of, like, why are you doing this wild child routine? You're just making, like everyone knows mom. We all know that mom's a pain in the ass. Why are you, like, kicking directly against the goads, like... Activate your stealth drive, sister, and you know, because I was out doing crazy shit. I was blowing shit up out in the woods and shooting AK-47s, SKSs, and going out and cruising downtown Indianapolis at 3 o'clock in the morning. My mom had no idea.
Yeah,
but I kept up the appearances, and my life, like I guess I had a slightly smoother experience than my sister did.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I don't know, but that there is definitely a. It's definitely a price you pay for wearing that mask, too.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe it has something to do with where you place the blame for that situation.
Uh-huh.
You know, like if Camille sees the root of her problems as her mother, that could be an issue. And I'm curious to see more about her backstory, especially like right after her sister dies, how things develop in that family, because I think that's going to be highly influential.
Right, right. So I want to talk about the town of Wind Gap, which we are informed only has 2,000 people in it, and it's full of old money and trash, which is another thing that reminded me of my hometown, because essentially you had people that were, you know, that worked in the big city, but you also had
Rick Smiths on the outskirts of town.
We had some, like, old, like, the guys that owned the gravel pits. Like, that's the other thing about my hometown. Every fucking way you can get to my hometown, you have to drive past this big, stinking gravel pit. You know? But the Perrys, who owned the gravel pits, lived out in the mansions out in the country, and they had the gated communities and all that kind of, almost exactly like this situation with Camille. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that, whoever's daddy owned this hog slaughtering farm, which, by the way, is super evocative, because as you're going through these dripping, bloody hooks in the credit sequence, is that hogs? Is that teenage girls? Who knows?
Long pork.
But yeah, like you happen to own the pig slaughtery or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's it. There was nothing. I mean, there's nothing else. There's no high tech jobs. There's no. Mm-hmm. It's there's no real way to advance. The odd grudges people have for, like, I thought it was telling the chief, how he leveled this when she tried to build common ground with him, like, well, you know, I'm from this small town too. He's like, well, you moved away. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a possible crime she committed. Like, you committed grand theft identity by stealing yourself from the town. You think you're better than us?
Like, yeah, essentially. That's what it is, you know?
Yeah.
People feel like if you leave, you think you're better, you're holier than thou, you know?
Or
holier than thou, but like better than thou.
That's often not untrue. A lot of people moving away from small towns do so because they don't see themselves in that small town life.
I feel like if it's not true when they leave, it becomes true over time because they get exposure to other interesting ideas and other kinds of people, and that makes them better.
Yes. I thought it was interesting how not only did Camille and her sister, when they're kids, roller skate. Uh-huh. But, like, there's still this roller skating pack of team. Like, there's a weird unstuck time kind of thing about that.
And they play with that, too. Like, she looks down an alley at one point, sees some skaters go by.
And, oh, is this another flashback?
Right. Is that alley, like, teleporting her to the past or something?
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting, inside the police office, there was, like, so you got this small town that probably, you know, current events notwithstanding, you don't have a lot of crime, you know, and what little crime you do is probably like domestic abuse, domestic sexual abuse, domestic physical abuse, all that kind of stuff. But yet the police office is covered in, like, these are the deadly errors you can commit on a stop and get killed. Don't be a victim. Like, there's all these posters about how on guard you have to be and how, like, fucking weird that is. To extol this, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And the woman at the police station is also very much like, things are bad out there. We won't let our kids leave the house, you know, that kind of stuff. And it doesn't seem like a reflection.
Having our kids sleep
like
in our beds now, because that's more healthy than...
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. It almost didn't feel like a reflection of the events in that town, but the events at large in the world, right? Uh-huh. And I know there's a recent disappearance of a kid, so people are going to overreact to that. But I don't know. It did feel like an overreaction.
It's weird because it's almost like in these small towns, like anytime the illusion of control is shattered. Like in a city, random shit happens to you all the time. Like your car will just get a new ding. And how did it happen? I don't know. There's trash in your yard. Oh, someone must have walked. Like, you know, stuff like that just happens. And you kind of get inured to a basic amount of being jostled by other people. But in these small towns, you can literally feel like everything is a clockwork mechanism and you're on God's country and like every, you know, that. And then something like this happens and they lose their fucking mind because that control is gone. Mm-hmm. The one thing I thought was weird is the censor bar. It's the town bar that her old childhood friend owns that I think they intimated used to be a gay bar. And then he took it over and they don't get those types like that anymore. In a small town of 2,000 people in rural Missouri, I can't imagine a gay bar.
It doesn't seem like one would spring up there. Certainly not an open gay bar.
Yeah.
Like, that might be the place where gay people go to hook up.
But even then, like, there's got to be a suburb of 20, 30,000 people that could have a censors. Sure.
Right. But like 2,000 people.
Yeah. But a lot of times that, like, I noticed that same thing in like Twin Peaks. Like, that felt so much like a rural town, but it also had a casino and it had a brothel and it had.
Right.
That has to have some like, I don't. Yeah. I don't. That felt very out of place, like, and even in them lampshading it by saying, well, that we essentially ran them out of town and we don't get those types anymore. I don't think you got those types in 1992 either, dude. in the middle of Bush versus Clinton.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out like why someone would come to a place like Wind Gap and try and start a business that revolves around a community that doesn't really exist there.
And I don't want the people to mistake that I don't think there's gay people in Wind Gap. Like,
sure.
This is like Shit Town.
We're talking about
the podcast.
Openly gay.
We're talking about people yeah. that are just going to start a gay bar right. and be open. And I mean, I'm not saying it because I think that's a great thing. And I'm not trying to erase the very real rural gay people that are out there. I'm just saying that, like,
sure.
a gay bar and a 2,000 town population in the Midwest.
There's more friction to that kind of business than in that location
yeah.
than there would be in many other places in the country.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah,
a shame,
yeah.
but
yeah.
it's true.
Yes. But yeah, other than that, I thought just the way that like they described you treat out of towners, how you just kind of smile until they leave you alone because mm-hmm. you know, the attitude is they don't have anything that they can teach you and they are looking down at you and that the whole experience is unpleasant and you're starting to feel, you know, like judged, like all that stuff felt pretty accurate.
Let me ask you this. The guy running the bar currently, her friend, is he the same kid that saw her in the lake when he was out shooting
that,
with his friends?
Oh, I never even thought about that, but that might be.
They look kind of similar.
That might be.
Given 30 years of alcoholism.
I don't know, because that's the other thing I want to talk about is Teen Camille. There's an ominous order to these flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
You see very pretty, attractive teenage cheerleader wearing outfit Camille running from some boys in the woods, and it seems like fun. Like, she's at the end of the scene, she's got like a mischievous grin. Then the next time you see her, she's shaved off all her hair. There's this teenage boy is pointing a gun at her, mm-hmm. Which, you know, violates all four, manages to violate all four of the basic rules for firearm safety.
And she's not with her sister, so we assume it takes place after.
But the short hair is before her sister's death. So we know it's not.
Oh, hmm.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm wondering, and we also, she goes to this that's somehow connected to this shack that she goes to where there's all this hardcore pornography and dead animals hung up. I'm assuming that's like a hunting shack for these little local boys, and they're just, these little psychopaths are just murdering everything in the woods. But
they got a hold of some really nasty magazines. Like,
they
this
did.
This is some BDSM shit. Like,
yeah, they must have been, made the drive to the big dirty city and came back with their haul.
I guess so.
Or you know what? That's the other thing is, like, it wouldn't surprise me if there's some kind of truck stop, lion's den, adult emporium.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing. It's endemic to like the South and Midwest. Is like, you won't find that shit anywhere. But when you do find it, it's like this weird overbuilt mecca of you know, like I what,
and it's
what,
right next to the giant cross.
Yes, there'll be a 300-foot cross uh-huh. casting its shadow over the thing. But there's still cars in the parking lot, and people are getting it. So
why is the quintessential Midwest childhood experience finding porn in the woods?
Because where else are you going to find it?
Everywhere else. There's literally every other place is a better place to find it. Than the middle of the woods, and yet it always shows up in the woods.
But I mean, I feel like they're going to where these boys violated her, and
they haven't really, gone that direction yet. But I'm worried
trying to wipe off her little sister's lipstick while she's in the casket, kind of like that's to me, like trying to protect her, like even post mortem innocence. And I don't know, because also. Adora, her mom, split from her dad. You know, that could just be, first of all, Adora's a nightmare, so congratulations for getting out of her orbit, dude. But and also that's a well-known consequence for like losing the kid. Like, a lot of marriages don't withstand that strain.
Yeah.
But also, you know, this type of thing makes me think like maybe there was something bad about the dad.
Mm-hmm.
Is he completely out of the picture?
Well, I mean, I wanted to talk about who you think is some of the primary suspects in this case so far. Just knowing how these things go, I feel like the stepdad is a primary suspect.
You think
me.
So?
He
reads as completely clueless to me.
But that's just the disguise you need.
Huh.
That's just this detached, sort of aloof nature to him hides something worse. It always does in these stories. But I don't know. He's my prime suspect currently.
There's a couple things I think that let's talk about the mystery now. So we had a teenage girl that was strangled by clothesline last year, mm-hmm. and another one just went missing.
I think the first one's name is Anne. Is that right? Anne, and the second one is Natalie.
Anne Nash. Anne Nash and then Natalie Keene.
Okay.
So we're introduced to two of their family members, and only two of their family members. Well, I guess there's some sisters on Anne Nash, but we meet Natalie Keene's brother, mm-hmm. who has turned to underage drinking. He seems like he's like already assuming his sister's dead before she's found. I think we're supposed to think that's fishy, but to me, I don't know. Like I feel like that's in the range of normal reactions to be kind of like your sister got abducted on the heels of another girl being abducted and killed, and you just go to that dark place. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing seemed inherently suspicious. And when Amy Adams kind of when Camille rather went in there to like break up these kids that are like looting her memorial, like the answer she got from those didn't seem like Jill and her friends on The Leftovers, who are like super callous, you know, doing stuff to feel they feel like they're genuinely sorrowful and this is the way they're acting naturally. Mm-hmm. And then also Ann Nash's dad, who is a fucking mess.
He's also prime suspect.
It's so weird because I kind of liked the guy, and there's this point where his daughter barges in without knocking, and I'm like, oh, this might go to some weird place. But he's like, if you don't knock again, I'm going to put it on your chart. Like, this isn't a guy that beats his kids. This is a, you know, he's weird, but he lives in a small town. But then when he starts talking about how it must be a gay slur for a man that did it because she wasn't raped, and I would rather her mm-hmm. die than be raped, and knowing what we know about Camille, to me, that was just like shocking, like how vicious that turned.
Yeah, he turned borderline violent,
right?
In that moment, and I was genuinely concerned for Camille being, you know, door closed, backed into a corner here with a man who thinks he's being accused of
something. Because like he invited, like, he's very like menacing, not. I mean, he's just looking for a private place to talk in their small
house. Initially, it was
okay, but you shut the door with a woman in your bedroom. Yeah. That's an awkward situation.
Mm-hmm. I was actually concerned when I saw her moving toward the opposite end of the room. I'm like,
yeah,
you need to let him move toward the opposite end of the room. You stay by the door.
Yeah. But he also mentions that she chopped her hair off rather than be put in the rollers, which you're supposed to, because they cut right over to Amy Adams' face when she says that, and she has like this thoughtful look on. You're supposed to make the connection between herself as a younger woman cutting her hair off and what this daughter did as rebellion. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting, but like this gives us this attitude of like you'd rather your daughter be murdered than raped.
Yeah,
that is a wild statement to make.
Sure,
that places an intrinsic value on a woman's quote unquote virtue as higher than her own life. Mm-hmm. What the fuck? That guy's definitely a suspect.
Yes.
So some people, like, there's definitely some false suspects. Like, are we supposed to, like, I kind of feel like we're supposed to be a little bit suspicious of the out-of-town detective, but...
The cop, yeah.
But he's out of town. Like,
he's out of town, but maybe he's in town because he was out of town.
This is a backdraft situation where it's the policeman doing the murders he's wanting a serial to make his career, and he made a serial to make his career.
Could be.
I
don't either. I think this is going to be the romantic interest for Camille, if there is one.
Yeah.
I'm kind of hoping it doesn't go that direction, and this is going to be more of a playful adversarial thing and not romantic. But
it'd be wild to see what happens because, like, her whatever she's gone through has her sexual fantasies seem like they're pretty dark. Mm. Like, there's a scene where she pleasures herself, but it's to the memories of this weird murder sex cabin.
Yes.
And you know, it'll be interesting to see what this guy makes of all that. Like, if those scars are real, for example, that is a topic of, I mean, that must be, I wouldn't even know what it is like to have, if those are real, to have those on your body and to get like naked to someone for the first time.
Oh man.
Like,
yeah,
that's an interesting conversation.
Let me ask
you. And you're so vulnerable when you have it, too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like, being naked is vulnerable enough, no matter what. Like,
Let me ask you this. Do you think by the end of this 8-episode run that Camille is going to be any closer toward, let's say, happiness?
Man.
Or do you think this is a story of just going to be a dark story?
I think this is going to be, I mean, if it's, there's going to be some happiness, it's going to be True Detective happiness where the light's winning.
Uh-huh.
But there's still a whole lot of black and just pinpricks of light.
Yeah, I really don't see this going well for her.
Yeah, because there's no, like, unless this thing spans a decade and has intensive psychotherapy, like, right. I don't see, like, a person like Camille getting healthy by the end of, like, maybe she's on her steps to that, like, she's putting her first step to some sort of recovery.
That's kind of what I mean, like, oh, maybe in a budding relationship with this cop from wherever he's from, maybe, like, there's going to be some window to happiness for her. She's not going to be there, obviously.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
She can see maybe a light at the end of the tunnel. I don't think so. I think it's going to be darker.
What do you think of the chief suspect? Did we already talk about that?
Yeah, I think he's a suspect. He
I don't think he's a. I think he's a red herring type of suspect.
Yeah, I feel that.
Because like I think her analysis is right on that he. Well, I don't know because he says he has no leads. And she says that she believed it because it was like the angry kind of defiance, like, I feel like I should have a lead. I'm a chief of police and I've been doing this for a year and I got these, all this hypervigilant shit on my walls and I don't have any. But then later on, I felt like, the out of town detective does have something, but it might be something that came up because of the investigation of the girl's body. Cause they find the body of, Natalie by the end of the episode.
Right. They do.
But there's also, now that I was looking at my notes, there's also a lot of like little digs to support that this town doesn't really value women's actual opinions because like Natalie's like wanted poster, or I forget what it was, but it's like all done in purple, which is her favorite color. Oh, actually, it's her second favorite color. Her favorite color is black, but
right.
Her mom thought that was too morbid.
Yeah,
like you know, like this whole like just basic disrespect for people's wishes over appearances,
mm-hmm.
Which also strikes. I thought this strikes a very good tone for this small town stuff.
Okay, I got one other major suspect.
Okay,
developing here. It's Celia from Weeds. I don't know her name in this. It's
the
friend who greets her when she returns to town.
Yeah, Elizabeth Perkins.
Yeah, and she's sitting there kind of helping with the investigation, but not helping.
She's getting her special tea tied on, is what she's doing.
She's doing as little as possible to help. With this investigation, while still looking like she's helping with the investigation,
yeah,
and it's
Jackie, that's her name.
It becomes weird when Amy Adams is walking away, when Camille's walking away from her, and she's like, "Beauty, beauty, beauty."
Right.
I was like, "Oh, that's creepy, lady."
Yeah, and there's like all this, like these women.
She seems almost resentful of the beauty of this woman, and I'm a little worried.
Her and her mom both do have McClaras as that, like, that brittle, fading beauty. They're trying to hold on to that just a little bit longer and resentful because that's their worth, right? That's, like, what
sure.
Everything's all bound up in that appearance, and when it starts to, when the rose starts to wilt, like, it's got to be pretty tough.
Yeah, she's a suspect as well.
I think that's another thing that gets, like,
Not raped? Maybe she's just not into girls?
Oh.
But she is into killing beauty.
Interesting.
I don't know.
I don't know, because like you could also, there's like so many. It's funny how the guy goes to like, well, it must be a gay man, because there's so many other, like the person could be asexual.
Mm-hmm.
The person, as you mentioned, could be a woman. There's
straight
lots,
woman anyway.
Lots of things that could lead to a woman being murdered and in some sort of weird kind of fetishistic way that doesn't involve sex and, you know, nobody. And then I wonder if that's one of the interesting things is like none of the town folks can conceive that because
right.
It doesn't fit in their worldview.
The prejudice they have. Yeah.
Right. It gets in the
blinding
way.
Blinding them.
Speaking of like Adora is the type of rich white person that has a black maid in like the maid uniform and everything
in
2018.
The Obama era. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, wow. Someone in the forums like maybe she's the ghost because that's just like, it's such a
yeah.
anachronism, you know?
Uh-huh.
So what else we want to talk about? We talked about the mystery. I don't know.
That's about all I've got.
Let's talk about some feedback. We're going to be doing this each week. If you guys are interested in sending it in to us, you can send our feedback in to tv@baldmove.com. You can also go on our forums and discuss it. I'm going to have a weekly thread. I will say that, like, if you've read the book, and I know several people have, because it's a very popular book. It was the debut, I believe, book by Gillian Flynn, who mm-hmm. wrote Gone Girl and a bunch of other subsequent books. I know a lot of people have read the book. I'm trying to, and a lot of these questions that we're asking this podcast could have been easily, obviously, cleared up if you've read the book. So please don't spoil us. If you wouldn't mind, or anybody else in the forums, but we mm-hmm. we'll have an episode discussion on the forums, forums.baldmove.com, if you'd like to contribute there. And if book readers want to start a spoiler thread so they can talk about, because I know that's fun to talk about the adaptation, feel free to do so. I'm just going to do the non-spoiler one going forward. So let's get to that feedback. Groovy Dooley wrote in on the forums, anyone else have their anxiety activated in the opening sequence of the two girls running with their backpacks open? Did you not feel...
Like stuff's just going to fall
yeah,
out?
Yeah, me and Cesar are like, what are you doing running around with your backpacks open?
Yeah, that's such a kid move.
Your shit's going to fall out, man. You're never going to find your... I don't know.
Stacks of porn you have.
Yeah, the stacks of bondage porn.
Right.
You're never going to find that. But no, I felt you there. AJ opined that this show has by far the best soundtrack of any TV show I can think of.
Zeppelin, I heard the same Zeppelin song multiple times.
If you like a lot of 70s rock,
yeah.
I don't know, there's a lot of shows that have pretty tight soundtracks. Like, my money for right now probably goes to The Deuce.
Hmm.
Soundtrack season one was amazing.
Westworld's got an amazing soundtrack.
There's lots of
piano
people.
Covers, yeah.
Lots of people in the running there. Garth Gow says, man, that was some gripping television. As someone who has struggled with the whole drinking thing, Amy Adams is about the best looking alcoholic I've ever seen.
Yeah,
that did take me out of it a bit, to be honest. People that drink that much tend to look like death, but maybe, as someone mentioned, it's a more recent thing. Maybe we just don't know.
They did what they could to take a beautiful woman and make her look as normal as they could.
Right.
She's clearly above average in physical appearance.
Right. And they even talk about in the show that, like, she is the prettiest girl in Wind Gap or whatever.
True, yeah.
So, but there's also, like, hints that maybe she's had a more recent, like, problem mm-hmm. with the conversation she had with the boss and stuff. So we'll have to see. I really love Patricia Clarkson, but God, she's insufferable here. Every scene that takes place at her family's house is so uncomfortable. It makes me wonder why she even checked out of the motel to stay with her mom. That's a very good question, because no fucking way would I ever... I mean, my mom and I have an even worse relationship, but even if we were in the stage where, like, we still made polite conversation every couple months, no way would I ever stay for several days.
Yeah.
What do you think got into her? And also,
I wonder if there's a hotel in the town. I don't know if there's a
place
to stay.
There's that motel. It wasn't a great one. It was pretty gross.
It was a motel?
Yeah, when, she checks in the first one. It's pretty gross. It's not very clean. It's a motel.
I don't remember that.
I mean, you know, like, in our hometown, there were several, like, motels along, like, 67 mm-hmm. and whatnot. I know people do stay in them. I would never stay in one. Like, yeah. There are certainly motels I do and would stay in, but, like, some of this stuff can be nightmare fuel. But I thought that was, maybe it's just like, well, my mom lives in a mansion, and I'm here in this place that hasn't been cleaned, or it's, like, got roaches around, maybe.
Yeah, they have a very strange relationship, you know, even if it's one that I understand kind of in a lot of ways. I don't know that I can explain why she would go stay with her mother in that situation. Wouldn't it look weird if her daughter came to town and didn't stay with her?
Hmm.
Like, how would that reflect on her mother, you know?
Does Camille care? I mean, she cares a little bit.
She cares, yeah. She does care.
She cares enough to be, like, and instead of, like, truly assertive, she matches her mom's passive aggressiveness with her own. Because, like, when her mom, like, is... barbing her, she barbs back. Like, when she asks after her sister and she's like, you know, why are you asking? It's like, I'm just being polite. We do that to big city, you know. Like, it's a dance they're doing.
That's true.
Did you find it slightly unrealistic that Camille would have no idea what her half-sister looks like, to the extent that she wouldn't recognize her on the street? Like, she hasn't been getting
Christmas
cards. I guess
it depends on how many years. Yeah.
Does
Are we talking, like, a 4-year-old to a 15-year-old she hasn't gotten cards?
Hmm. Yeah,
sure,
maybe.
Sure, I could see it.
Yeah. Do you think Adora... Like, Adora seems like the type to be on Facebook all the time, though.
You think so?
Yeah, just boozily judging her friends' lives and making passive-aggressive comments. And although, I don't know, like, an idle, rich Midwesterner, maybe not.
What is the stepdad going to do with that stereo system? He's going to knock this house down with that stereo system, man.
I don't know. It's weird. It's like
it's
a
huge.
Weird turntable system where you actually crank down the yeah. the records.
And it's all like modern looking in mm-hmm. this old Victorian era.
It's his new toy.
Yeah.
You think he's rich or did he marry into the old money?
That's a good question.
Her stepdad's just a bowl full of tapioca pudding, man.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't pick him out of a lineup. I have no idea what mm-hmm. he looks like. It's a vague hair and glasses and a cardigan, I think, that was, like, tied over. Like, it's...
I need to get a good look at him, but I think they showed a young version of him in the town at the sister's funeral trying to pull
Camille
off.
I thought that
Camille
was
off.
Maybe her real dad. Or her
but
biological dad, I should
as
say.
As I remember it, it looks so much like him.
Maybe, but then again,
but I'm not sure.
It could be two bowls of tapioca pudding.
It could be, yeah. But I just their faces blend.
Right, you just didn't know. Which, by the way, like by the time that scene hits, I wasn't there to judge Camille. But like, what a shit show of a funeral! Can you imagine? Yeah. Like, I was thinking, like, what would it be like to be, and to a narcissistic mother that's literally like shooting her in the face with a shotgun.
No, I mean this is. Camille returns 30 years later, mm-hmm. and this is one of the first things her mother brings up. Don't mm-hmm. embarrass me again. She's referring to that moment
maybe
at the funeral.
There could be other ones, but like I'm just saying like that's the kind of thing where I think a normal mother would be like, wow, that's fucked up. My kid's hurting. I need to get her help. Like Adora would just shame and be angry. How dare you make us look like
this?
What would your sister say? Blah, blah, you know, and like lay it on real thick.
Yeah.
Going back to Garth guy, we got a little bit away from you there, buddy, for a minute. I also got a weird vibe from her editor. It seems like something has happened recently with her and he's trying to help her get her act together, but she doesn't seem like someone who would open up easily to people, much less her boss. Then there's that odd moment where he is told by his wife, I think that he isn't Dr. Phil. Why would she be there listening to his conversation with her? That's the last comment you make is pretty interesting. I do think that if you have a boss and you're missing a lot of work or you're going through a tough time, like it's certainly the legal reality that you just tell them that you're going through. You don't have to tell them anything. You just need mm-hmm. personal time off and have to. But like, I feel like in practice, it's very hard not to elaborate.
Yeah.
You know, unless you just like hate, like unless you're talking about a McDonald's type of job or a Walmart type of job. Like if you're in a professional white collar environment, you have a relationship beyond just the, like time clock and signing this and granting this request. Like,
and let's not forget, we're dealing with a journalist here, right? Somebody who is paid to investigate things.
Right.
They're going to dig a little bit.
Yeah. And there's also, I think, a little bit of a mentor, like, you know, a mentor role there too. Like he's like trying to bring out the best in her and like, you know, kind of like, she's at the stage of her career whether it's she's going to level off here and it's not going to go any further, or she could really dig deep and do something amazing. And he's wanting her to do that. But I feel like he's really throwing her into a lion's den that he can't even conceive of.
Yeah. Sure, I'm with you.
Because I find, like, when I talk to, like, whenever I have a frank discussion about, like, my family dynamic with people, like, people don't even want to believe it. They want to believe, like, I'm making it up, or, well, that's not true, or, like, well, she's still your... people can't conceive how bad and toxic things can get with inside families, I think. And
people who don't have those types of relationships,
And you certainly don't just assume that, you know, when you meet someone for the first time, you think everybody... You know, I imagine you think everybody has a, you know... A okay childhood growing up. He says, overall, I liked it, but damn, it was grim. It looks like it's only going to get worse. Great meditation on grief and trauma. Well, we haven't had one since Leftovers, so I'm in the mood for one. Also, shots at Westworld. Westworld should take note this episode is able to tell a story with an unreliable narrator, flashbacks, secrets, visions, and still have it be as intriguing as hell while not frustrating the audience. Yeah, but season 1 of Westworld did that too. Like, sharper objects would have a much tougher time, and sharpest objects would have a tougher time. Like this stuff, I think the reason this stuff collapses under its own weight more often than not is because it's very hard to give people that feeling of being immersed into a new mystery.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, just getting all, like, it, like, doing that, like, okay, that's a cool magic trick, now do it again, now do it again, now do it again. Like, it's harder and harder to repeat that. Finally, our buddy Shum, who commissioned the, if you might remember, commissioned the Buffy the Vampire Slayer podcast series, said, in my role as the officially unofficial Bald Move Joss Whedon correspondent, I wanted to give you a rundown of my experience with Sharp Object show creator Marty Noxon. She started writing for Buffy the Vampire Slayer in Season 2. Among the Buffy writers, except for maybe Joss himself, I always thought her scripts were the most consistently good and had the best character work. Some characters would feel a little off in the hands of other writers, but Noxon always wrote her characters perfectly. In Buffy Season 6, she took over as showrunner while Joss worked on Firefly. Season 6 is considered a series low point by many fans, and many of them blame Marty Noxon. I never thought this was fair. Joss may have been able to punch up the scripts a bit had he been more involved, but I believe that Season 6 would have been gone darker than most fans wanted, regardless of who is in charge. Marty didn't write for Joss much after Buffy, but you might recognize her as the woman trying to get out of a ticket in the Buffy musical episode. I do remember that. As one of the news anchors in the Dr. Horrible sing-along blog. More recently, she has created several shows of her own, usually on random third-tier cable networks, including Lifetime, Bravo, and Teen Nickelodeon. I was pretty impressed with her Lifetime show Unreal, which is a drama about a producer on a Bachelor-style reality show. I thought it did a great job illustrating how fake these shows are and the terrible things producers will do to create drama and turn real complex people into crude stereotypes. I also watched To the Bone, which is a Netflix movie starring Lily Collins and Keanu Reeves about 20 years ago. And Keanu Reeves about a 20-year-old girl struggling with anorexia. I thought it was very moving, though sometimes harrowing look at anorexia and eating disorders. How did I miss a Netflix movie starring Keanu Reeves? Have you seen that one?
I haven't seen it, but I've seen it around.
I have not.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to go back and apologize to Netflix for not shoving their stuff. Like, how did you miss the Keanu connection there? You know so much about me, Netflix, because I watch for hours a day. She worked on several other shows I haven't checked out, but I think Noxon is very talented, and I'm excited to see what she does with the show. Yeah, so far, so good. Seems like it's got pretty decent bones with the book by Gillian Flynn, and I love the direction. I love the writing. I'm pretty excited. So, yeah. Anything else we want to talk about?
I don't think so.
All television. Again, if you want to send us feedback, tv@baldmove.com, or get on our forums, forums.baldmove.com, and we will be back next week for the next episode of Sharper Object. Sorry, next week of Sharp Objects. We'll buy something from Sharper Images. I need some
and
sort
watch
of
Stranger Things, which I always get confused with the name.
Strangest Things.
Yep.
We'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Later.